Accession number 30034, Reel 5.
Had her in the back seat with Andy Cutler and his girlfriend riding in the front seat. And Don Marshall says, "Stop the car. Stop the goddamn car." So Andy stopped the car. And he pushed this girl out and closed the door and told Andy to drive on. Well, it seems as though she had told him, he doesn't kiss like my other boyfriend does. Her other boyfriend at the 99th truck company was all black.
Oh!
And this guy is a southerner. That didn't work too well. We're 10 here. On page 187, John McDonald was a little bit different. And the strain of flying over Festung Europe, I think, got to John one night, and he got everybody in the barracks, and I was living in the wheelhouse at this time. Got everybody in the barracks, and he had a 45, and he had them all lined up, and he was threatening to kill them. And somebody had gotten out the door, and they got the MPs, and MPs were outside, you know, the glass was pretty thin anyway. And he's ranting and raring and roaring about these people. These are all pilots that he's got in here. And he has let go a couple of shots, so, you know, they know that it's for real. And they maneuvered him next to a window. And we had a big Indian guy that was an MP. He was big. They just took this club and went right through the window and all. And got John. And they hauled him off in a straitjacket. And I have no idea whatever became of him. We're getting to the point now where
the guys are claiming off you. The guys you didn't know very well.
Marvin Becker, I've seen. They're beginning to come and go a little faster than I can keep up with. And some of them I know and some I don't. Quite a number of them are already dead. War Boys, I see him. He flies for some private firm. Eugene Timoney, who I used to have on my wing quite frequently, was a good aviator. And he came in one day and said, "Major," he said, "I don't mind flying your wing, but," he says, "they shoot at you and they hit at me." And he says, "Couldn't I fly with somebody else once in a while?" I saw Tim in the Air Academy 5 years ago, and he died the next year. One of my favorites. Bob Daniel visited, he and his wife, visited here, and we were laughing about time he landed at Antwerp and stood his airplane up on his nose, and the Germans owned the north side and the British owned the south side of the runway. And I never asked Bob why he stood it up on his nose, but I landed and threw my parachute out and sat on his lap and brought him home. And so, of course, we reported 16 pilots back and 15 airplanes. And I got my can ringed out for that from some nit in the 65th wing, you know, that you can't do that sort of thing. And as I reminded Bob when I was here, I said, you know, we're both damn lucky because I had been hit badly in the tanks and that stuff used to swell up. And I had been hit enough times and swollen up and showed me with a lot of fuel. But in fact, I only had about 3 or 4 gallons of fuel. So we both could have gone down there, I see.
Was it Orton himself?
It was Orton's. It was not Orton himself. It was one of his operations. Yeah, one of his operators. A lieutenant colonel, as I remember.
When did that happen?
Well, whenever the British were taking Antwerp.
Autumn of 44.
Yeah. Sometime in the moment. Pop said it was very uncomfortable. I only weighed about 113 pounds. It's going to be that uncomfortable. But anyway, I had him back, and the airplanes were easy to come by, and pilots were not. I would rather have him. But once you lost them over there, it took you weeks to get them back.
Mm.
You know, work their way through the system.
They got a vent drop, I take it.
Yeah. No, they just put a new engine.
New engine and prop in. Mm.
Fly it off. Oh, we'll see. Number 24 on page 189 was John C. Farringer. Now, John had been in my upper class at primary flying school, and John had given me, in particular, a very hard time. Upper class, do you understand how they worked that in flying school? And John was almost sadistic. And guess who got him in his squadron? However, I never picked on John. I thought about it, and I figured, no, war just moved on. Then he came in and forgot his gear one day and landed on the wing tanks. And I just said $50, and that was all there was to it. I didn't do anything else. Let go. But we were planning, Dave Schilling had volunteered us to go to Merseburg, I believe it was Merseburg, to bomb the Luna oil works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We went out and practiced flying through the smokestacks out in the Midlands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that was a very smart thing, but we lost one pilot by the name of Sox, S-A-U-X.
Mm-hmm.
He crashed doing that. And but this was going to be David's Congressional Medal run, and the rest of us were all going to get lots of medals and so on. I had John flying my wing, and my job was to drop a bomb through the window, not a very big window, I might add, of the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, it was something like 900 guns in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured that our chances were not too shiny.
They weren't.
And fortunately, Patton's people took it about 3 days before we would go.
Mm-hmm.
We went up. But that was all selected, all volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
To go. Every squadron commander, group ops, and squadron ops.
Mm-hmm.
There would have been a massive turnover of rank.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about him?
What about who?
This fellow.
Farringer?
You, yeah.
He stayed in the Air Force. He went to the Strategic Air Command.
Mm-hmm.
Which, no, I guess. Well, if you wanted to get promoted during peacetime, you went to SAC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what John wanted. I've won here 12. Rambo Murphy called Pat, an excellent pilot, shot down a couple of airplanes, big in the oil business in Texas. All I know is he's got a lot of money. Sam Batson, of course, we've already kicked Sam around, he's dead. 17 was Wade Charlton, was a dentist, and a very successful dentist, I know that. No, just don't remember the rest of them. Too many faces.
Some of those may not have come in until after you left.
Yes. Well, these were all October 44. Oh, I was there. We were running a double group, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, pilots after years. They had A group and B group. Something I never see mentioned that I would like to get on their thing is a thing called spider flight. Ever hear of that?
No.
Well, Dave had this idea. We got hit by some 109s we were up around 35, and these guys came down on us, which meant that they had to be up around 40. And this happened twice. So what we did is, the 63rd, we took four guns out, we took all the armor plate out, took the armor class out, took some of the instruments out, and then we would go over in that flight. Those four airplanes would go over at 45,000 feet, just to make sure nobody was going to come down. We did that for probably 3 or 4 weeks. It was called Spider Flight.
This must have been late in the war then, right?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. Probably October.
Yeah.
No, you heard of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I asked somebody about that, and nobody seems to remember that.
Well,
the crews remember it, because they had to take the damn armor plate out.
Yeah. But well, we were talking about personalities.
Yes.
You're talking about the 63rd Squadron. Now about some of the other squadrons, people that you knew.
Very few. Joe Perry, which I have discussed with you. Joe Perry, I knew him primarily through Donovan Smith. Donovan Smith and I were very close all throughout the war. Prior to the time we went over to England, and we stayed friends until he died several years ago of brain cancer. Les Smith, of course, and I, we had gone to school together, although I did not know him in school. He was from Fresno, and so I could at least speak to him. As far as the other people, I knew nobody in the other squadrons.
What was Donovan Smith like?
Very pleasant, somewhat naive in the beginning, and a very honest and intelligent, very loyal. Like many people, he saw Dave Schilling as a stepping stone to get ahead, and he stayed with Dave after the war. David and I parted company when all of us were working in the Pentagon, and David told me that he would talk to my boss, who was Felix Vidal, Brigadier General Felix Vidal, that he would talk to my boss and get me released from the Pentagon to rejoin the 56th Group at Selfridge. He was going to talk to him on Thursday. I was over at David's house along with Don Smith and Patty Smith and Barbara and Joe, and David remarked that he was going up to Selfridge on Thursday morning, and he could not possibly meet Felix Vidal Thursday afternoon if he was up at Selfridge, and it irritated me a little bit that I had already made arrangements with General Vidal to have Dave come down and talk to me. And I became miffed about it. Short temper never gets you anywhere, does it? And so I just told David, I said, you forget it. I said, I don't want to go to Selfridge. I will make my own way in this world. I should have gone to Selfridge because that became the core of the fighter groups in the United States Air Force. Those people up there, you can go through, and the generals and the colonels of the United States Air Force, most of them came out of that group that was at Selfridge. Don Smith, who was his nickname was Dieppe, because he somehow we had a raid on Dieppe of some sort, and he was associated with it, so his nickname was always Dieppe. If you knew him well, that was his nickname. But a very fine man, and one of the Don and I went to when we finished our tour, our second tour. General Spots invited us over through the auspices of a Colonel Stovall. Colonel Stovall had had a son who was in Don Smith's squadron. And Colonel Stovall was an ace from World War I. And I know when his son was shot down, his son let down into a stream of bullets from another T-47, one of the lieutenants in the same squadron. The lieutenant was shooting at the Focke-Wulf, and young Stovall let down right into the stream of bullets, and the lieutenant said that as soon as I saw the airplane, I stopped. But that was too late. The bullets are on its way, and they hit young Stovall, and apparently very hard. This was a subject for discussion on the way home. You know, you could hear the conversation between the aircraft, and I knew at that time that young Stovall had gone down, which didn't particularly bother me one way or the other. He was not in my squadron, and I, you know, had my squadron at home. But when I went up to the wheelhouse, I was the first one up there, and I went up to get a beer, I think, and here is Colonel Stovall. He has flown in from General Spotts' headquarters. He was chief of staff for General Spotts. And here sits Colonel Stovall, and I thought, oh my God. And so I greeted him, and he wanted to know how the mission went. I said, well, we've had a few losses, and we shot down a few. And I went back out, got in my Jeep, and I went and found Dave, and I said, hey, Colonel Stovall is up in the wheelhouse. And his remark was, oh, shit. And I can see it. You know, he had those boots on, and he had his hat on.
You didn't have to pull anybody up for bad maintenance or sloppy work, as you recall?
I had a maintenance officer, and if there was any bad maintenance, I knew about it, I expected him to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that a squadron commander should be down telling maintenance people how to run maintenance.
True.
Same with my supply people, my munitions people, and so on. Later on in life, when I had another squadron much later, the colonels and the generals who had not been squadron commanders had a great yen to come down and tell the squadron commanders how they ought to run their squadron. And I used to really take umbrage about that. They were frustrated squadron commanders when they ought to have been group commanders, wing commanders, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I did not try to run each unit. I had people who were responsible for it. I can tell you right now, in Vietnam, I had an ordnance officer who let one of his people wire a 750-pound bomb with safety wire. Safety wire is a very soft, brass wire, and high speed would have ripped it out, the bomb would have armed, and the lieutenant who was to fly it, who found it incidentally, could not have escaped. He would have been killed, absolutely, because the bomb would have armed. He could not drop it because we had explosive bolts that blew the bomb away. The explosion of the bolts would have set the bomb off, which would have blown him up.
Mm-hmm.
He could not land with it. That would be too much. It would kill him. I relieved that officer and sent him home to the States from Vietnam. I'm quite bitter about it.
Mm-hmm. You don't recall if there were anything like that ever happened in the 63rd?
If it did, I don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. You never had any pilots, to your knowledge, who complained to you of you know, bad maintenance or anything? Who didn't get on with their crew chiefs?
No. I don't recall of anybody. If they did, they would have gone to Carnahan, my maintenance officer, I believe. And, five, and his wife is 88, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, that's right. She's...
You like the older ladies.
Yeah, he's
Bob is a big liberal. He was delighted to tell me that he voted for Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer. And I said, well, you couldn't.
Don't mean to tell me he actually voted for Clinton.
Oh, yes, he did. Oh, absolutely.
Well, that's the first time I've heard of anybody who voted for the man.
Oh.
Somebody voted for that.
But anyway, I get along with Bob.
The actual relationships between the pilots and the ground crew men, what are your observations on that?
They were very close in the beginning. Towards the end, there were too many, and they were being cycled through.
You mean too many pilots?
Well, yes, that's right. And they did not, the old ones who had built up a rapport with their crew chief were going, and the new ones were coming in. The rapport was not quite as close. Everyone in the original crowd knew who their crew chief was, and who their assistant crew chief, armorer, communications man, and so on. But later on, sort of a mass production thing. And I'm talking now November, December of 44. Yeah.
Did you have pilots, second lieutenants and first lieutenants, who had a preference for people to lead them? Did you ever hear anything on those lines?
For preference for people to lead them?
Yes.
No, they wouldn't have told. They would not have told me.
Or the other way around. You wouldn't have heard of this.
No, that would have never gotten to a squadron commander.
And how about you, as a squadron commander, or before you were a squadron commander, did you ever have any views on the leadership? In other words, I mean, be perfectly frank with you.
Come on, Roger. No, we've gone through Tukey, we've gone through Burke, we've gone through Pete Dade, who I wouldn't have followed across the street.
But I'm talking about the skill of leadership in the air, not whether you didn't think much of a guy because he tended to be not looking for action.
The system worked fairly well. In other words, those who had been there the longest, who had caught on to the system, were the ones that we picked for leadership. And No, I don't recall.
You can never recall thinking.
I don't recall anybody ever coming to me and saying, you know, I don't want to follow him. He's terrible, or this sort of thing.
But did you, before you became a leader, did you ever feel, oh my God, fancy we've got to have him as a leader?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've already told you. I wouldn't have followed Pete Dade. I would have gotten off the mission. And that was something I never did. You know, I talked to you about going out behind the tail and puking. That's because I had 103 temperature. I would not abort a mission if I could avoid it.
But you just disliked Tukey's attitude more than his flying abilities or his leadership abilities, right?
He had no leadership ability.
But surely in the end...
I was always disappointed to be chosen to fly with him. I did not like to fly with him, but I suppose I could put it, I was a good soldier, and that's where I was supposed to fly. I flew, and I never asked to change.
Were you conscious of any discrimination within the leadership of the 56? Did you ever feel that Hub or Schilling had particular favorites that they would, you know, look after, or do you think they were both fair?
No, certainly not Hub. I don't recall Dave ever doing that. I can't speak for the other two squadrons. I know Lyle Adrians was a flight commander, and he was a terrible one. He was a follower of Tukey and Burke. He was, I'll give you top cover. If they had known how weak their top cover is, they'd have been scared to death. But he would never engage in a fight if he could avoid it.
Were you ever conscious of this thing which Hub, I don't know whether he was the architect or not, but this competitive spirit with the other groups. There's no doubt from what I've seen that the 56 was the one that started this business.
Yes.
They were not only fighting the Luftwaffe, they were going to be better than any of the other groups.
Not really. That's I put that down to my naivete, that I did not recognize the importance. I knew that we were in competition to some degree, but it was sort of a low-level degree to me. And I did not realize that Hub, this was a real driving force with him, was to nose everybody else out, particularly the fourth group, who I don't even want to call it friendly rivalry. It was flat-ass rivalry. And but it never came through to me how important it was for us to shoot down more airplanes. I think by that time I had been conditioned by the three that I mentioned, Burke, Adrians, and Tukey.
This
and having been hammered shooting down that first airplane demoralized me quite a bit.
This Sadie Hawkins Day thing was one of the first examples of this competitive spirit. Do you remember Sadie Hawkins Day?
Yeah, I do, very vaguely. Everybody got drunk.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
You don't know whose idea it was, do you?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Undoubtedly, it would have probably come out of the 62nd Squadron. They were great followers of their insignia. Was based upon Al Capp's cartoon of Little Abner. And that would be appropriate for Sadie Hawkins Day, probably from the 62nd.
Yeah. Was Schilling inventive or...?
No. Not like Hub. Hub was always looking for new ways to harass the Germans. The fan and the great hook idea, which I know you are aware of, where the Marquis said, hey, if you really want to take them out, we can do it much easier. No, Schilling didn't do that. The only time I remember Dave becoming inventive was spider flight. We got bounced from above, and that was bad news. And so a 63rd put four airplanes up at 45,000.
Were you the only squadron that did that, do you think? Or did the
as far as I remember, yes. But I'm not... That's too far back. Maybe the other two squadrons did the same thing.
Yeah. Belly tanks, or wing tanks, whichever you like to call them, any observations on their use, as far as you're concerned? Problems?
The engineers who came up with our original belly tank, that big pregnant elephant that we had, a paper tank, why they didn't figure out that hauling that weight around used up so much fuel that we really weren't making any progress with it. It did not extend our range to any great extent.
And it wasn't pressurized, was it?
No. I don't remember. It would have had to have been pressurized.
No, you couldn't fly.
Maybe not. I don't remember.
No, you couldn't fly with that above a certain altitude.
They came along with the metal wing tanks, and those were very good. Then they run out of metal, and they started using the paper tanks. The paper tanks were okay. Once in a while, the glass that connected them would break prematurely. Then, of course, you lost that whole tank. The young man who, was down in San Diego, Charlie Rossler, had a paper tank hang up on him one day, and we were about to engage. And I remember I moved in and took his tank off with my left wingtip.
Really?
Dinged up my wingtip, incidentally. Well, it was much easier to do that than to have him in this maelstrom that was right ahead. And he remembers that. I was surprised that he did.
What about the fuels? The Purple Peril, did that come into use when you were there?
The
very high
with
octane?
The high lead. The high and octane. We started losing engines with with lead pellets. Yes. Anybody who did not get trapped on that was just plain dumb lucky. It did not take long. I lost one pilot on that by the name of Glenn Hodges.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my wingman. He went down in the Skells and became a PW.
Because of detonation or what?
Pardon me?
Detonation of the
engine? Yeah, his engine just froze up on him.
Oh, froze up.
Well, it just detonated, and then he told me he was having engine trouble, and it was backfiring, he said. And then it just froze.
Did, I mean, was the fuel diagnosed as the cause fairly quickly?
Yes, probably within, I guess, 3 weeks.
And this is the stuff they call purple peril, was it? Because it was
I've never heard that term.
Mm. Died.
It was 150 grade fuel, as I recall it called. 150 grade fuel, high on lead.
Mm.
And
gave you more poke, I suppose.
Cut it out.
Yeah. Did you find that one P-47's performance, although they're all the same production line, one might be have a better performance or have certain idiosyncrasies or characteristics?
That should not be, but it is.
Mm.
And it's one of the reasons I am a firm believer in putting the pilot aircraft together.
Mm.
Because some of them had little idiosyncrasies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to ask me now what they were, I couldn't tell you.
Mm.
But you felt comfortable in your own.